coming out and stuff, I held it in after everyone else for a lot, after all the other victims for a lot longer, just because, you know, I was still under the belief that, you know, it was my choice. And it wasn't until eventually, at some point in my life, oh, when I was about 20, I ended up snapping, and that was kind of the big moment when I realised, hey, hang on a sec.
The web of deceit that he'd woven had gotten so deeply entrenched inside you that it convinced you for that long that actually you were at least partly to blame for what happened to you, even though you were a kid and he took full advantage of your vulnerability.
Yeah, exactly right.
That's Eden Van Haren, one of the bravest young men you're ever likely to meet. Eden is a survivor of sexual abuse, one of many to be preyed upon by a convicted pedophile. For 7 years, he internalised the horrendous trauma and didn't tell a soul, spiralling into deep depression that manifested in uncontrollable anger. In his early 20s, he found the courage to tell his family what he endured. Now 27, he spent years in court standing up to his abuser, fighting for compensation that he deserves and the rights of all victims. This is an extremely heavy episode. It's a very difficult story to tell, and that's part of why Eden speaking out is so important. If you or someone you know have been sexually assaulted, you can call 1-800-RESPECT for confidential support.
Welcome to Young Blood, the award-winning volunteer podcast dedicated to young men's mental health. My name's Callum McPherson, I'm a journalist, and this is a platform for everyday men to share lived experience stories and show that no matter what you're going through, you're not alone. Suicide is the number one killer of young people, and changing that starts with speaking up. So let's do it.
The Young Blood Men's Mental Health Podcast is a volunteer community service, and we rely on community support to bring this show to you. This episode is sponsored by Ski for Life, a charity committed to promoting well-being and suicide prevention. They've been running their annual ski relay on South Australia's Murray River for more than a decade, raising money to support community mental health initiatives. You can find out more about their cause at skiforlife.com.au.
Trigger warning, if you find anything spoken about in today's episode distressing, please contact Lifeline on 13 11 14.
Eden, what sort of kid do you remember being before the abuse?
When I was younger, timid, I guess you'd say nerdy almost, still a little bit athletic and all that sort of stuff. Just, I always put school first and, yeah, I was quite positive, I guess. Always saw the best in people. You know, the kind of kid that would see an old lady walking across the street and, you know, got run over and try and help her or something like that sort of thing.
So it's a gentle soul.
Yeah, yeah, a gentle soul.
And what about your family life? Like, you're quite close with your family?
I'm close with my family. When I was growing up, my parents did separate though. My father moved away to America when I was young, and that was definitely quite hard. As a kid, your father was always your idol and stuff like that. My mother is very much like me. Always
very caring, compassionate sort of person.
Yeah. Yeah. Always put everyone
emotional.
Yeah. 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 Definitely, I would say, gives too much of herself to everyone else. Step-parents are, you know, I don't know, I always hear about step-parents and how some of them are evil and all that sort of stuff, and I'm definitely lucky I've got, like, the best step-parents I could ever ask for. If anyone ever asked who they were, I'd just say, that's my mum or that's my dad.
So you were living with them for most of your childhood?
Yeah, so most of my childhood, I was living with my stepdad and mother in a town called Bega in New South Wales.
Yeah. And siblings as well?
Yeah, so I'm one of seven.
Whoa, one of seven?
Yeah.
Far out. Where are you in the pecking order?
I'm the second oldest. My elder brother, very much like my mother as well, just super generous and giving and caring. Then I've got, I mean, I just call them all my brother and sister, but there's a mix of...
Yeah, maybe don't try and spell all
that. Yeah,
So being second oldest, did it fall to you to be a bit of a protector, a bit of a mentor sort of in the family?
It definitely did. No, I shouldn't have, but when you're a teenager especially, you're always trying to look out and protect your family or, you know, your brothers and all that sort of stuff, even protect randoms on the street and stuff like that. Yeah.
Do you feel like you grew up a bit quicker because you had all these younger siblings and your dad left when you were so young?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah. Always trying to fend for myself. My family wasn't exactly their wealthiest.
But there was the attitude that you had to go and make stuff happen yeah. for yourself.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, at some point in my childhood, I was living in a caravan with my family, and it was more because of a business failure from my stepdad, and they needed money, so they rented out the house, and we went and lived in caravans.
And you had to have a job from an early age, or you chose to?
Yeah, yeah. I think first job I got was 12. I was walking dogs every afternoon after school.
Nice.
Yeah, I'd catch the bus there.
Best job you ever had?
Legit, yeah.
Did you have like 8 of them on leashes at once?
No, usually I think it only ever got to 2, but yeah.
Oh, right. Okay.
It was just a couple, and one of them was in the wheelchair and they needed help, so I used to walk the dogs for them.
Oh,
yeah.
You sweetie. That would have been cool.
I got paid, so.
Yeah, nice. Okay, yeah. So that wasn't easy. And then how did you come to be introduced to your abuser?
He was a neighbour of one of my friends and I don't know, kind of a big shot in a small town, I guess. And because growing up with not a lot, he used to, I don't know, being all awe of what people like that had.
So he was sort of flashing some wealth around?
Yeah,
just what, charismatic kind of a person?
Bit of both. At that point as well, I used to go over and do like various handyman jobs for him and stuff like that. And that was kind of...
Framed?
Yeah, yeah. You'd get paid or something like that, and you knew that you got paid extra if you were doing something else on the side or...
And how old were you at that time?
I was just over 14. We'd go over and, I mean, I'd go to my friend's house and then me and him would go over and do various things around the house, split firewood, move mulch or something like that. And then there'd be some sort of scenario where stuff would happen.
And was that always the case? Was there a time that you went there just to do whatever the handiwork was and then he somehow introduced that as well?
So the first time was not related to handiwork at all, just over there socialising. I think that was before any of the jobs and stuff like that. We were just relaxing in a spa and that's when, yeah, he made his move.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so then after that, it was often with the pretext of doing some jobs around the house or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Or a lot of it would be I'd be hanging out with his friend or something like that, with my friend, sorry, and he would offer me a lift home. And yeah, I knew if he was offering me a lift home, that's when it would happen in the car on the way home or something like that.
And he would offer you some sort of incentive for that, like money or it was just a psychological manipulation?
Psychological, yeah. And I guess at that age, I was very confused, had no idea what was going on. And it got to the point where, honestly, I kind of saw him as my father figure, if that made sense.
Yep.
Like one time I was driving a car and I was young down like in the state forest or something, and I rolled the car and like he was the person I called to pick me up. That's kind of how bad it got.
That's part of the big part of the manipulation, isn't it? Which is part of what makes it so confusing.
Yeah.
Because there's someone who's hurting you and at the same time they're pretending to be this figure in your life as well, which seems like a positive thing.
Yeah, and honestly, for a long time, you kind of think it's your choice. I don't know how to explain it.
Well, that part of the grooming is convincing, can be convincing whoever the victim is that it's between you and them and it's a special thing or that it's actually something that you yourself should enjoy being part of.
Yeah. Even, you know, coming out and stuff, I held it in after everyone else for a lot, after all the other victims for a lot longer, just because, you know, I was still under the belief that, you know, it was my choice. And it wasn't until eventually at some point in my life, when I was about 20, I ended up snapping. And that was kind of the big moment when I realized, hey, hang on a sec, something. Yeah.
Yeah. So the web of deceit that he'd woven had gotten so deeply entrenched inside you that it convinced you for that long that actually you were at least partly to blame for what happened to you, even though you were a kid and
he
took full advantage of your vulnerability.
Yeah, exactly right.
What sort of grooming tactics did he employ?
A lot of it was around like the being a supportive role model or trying to come across like a father figure or...
Just giving you that attention?
Yeah, there's, you know, money and stuff like that, which at that point in my life, my family, it seemed to me like my family was struggling with money a lot, so I guess I put a lot of burden on that. I used the money to buy my school laptop so I could study and stuff like that.
And he would have been aware of that.
Yeah, yeah.
So he came across as someone who was going to help with your situation and who was a good guy.
Exactly, yeah. And
which obviously on reflection is very hard to believe that you ever got there, but that is part of what abusers do.
Yeah, yeah. And me and my father back then didn't really have a great relationship, and the way I would describe it is he felt a bit more like an uncle to me, if that made sense. Mm.
Okay, so. But you were still looking for more time and attention and for someone to fill that role.
Exactly.
And in some ways he gave the appearance of doing that, but with these nefarious reasons for it.
That's pretty much smack bang, yeah.
So what was it like waking up every day and going about your life with this in the back of your mind and carrying that burden around, or knowing that there was this secret going on behind everything else that was happening?
Guilty. I don't know why I felt guilty about it, but I just felt guilty, like I was doing something wrong, or...
Like it was your fault.
Yeah, yeah.
But your feelings towards him at that time, there wasn't that hatred there, or...
No, at that time, I still confused, but at the same time, still tried to look for, you know, a paternal figure out of him. And
so it wasn't like a realization of this person who's an adult is doing this to me and I'm a victim. It was I'm having this relationship which I feel like I shouldn't be having, and that's because of me.
Yeah, yeah. It was one moment in time. It was all happening in his house or whatever, and we were near a window, and he said to me, he's like, come away from the window. And to me, that's one of the biggest ones, that one of my biggest like flashbacks, I'd say, is that moment where I just couldn't understand why he was telling me to go away from the window. And now, I don't know, I look back, I'm like, oh, it's because he didn't want to get caught. Yeah, I honestly just thought there was nothing wrong with it.
Like, thought there was nothing wrong with it from an outside perspective.
Yeah.
Like, you felt like there was something wrong with it internally.
Yeah, yeah.
But you weren't thinking of it in, like, legal terms there, or like it was pedophilia.
Yeah, yeah.
And you'd seen other stories, and did you think that, oh, that's not what this is, that's not what's happening to me, or...?
Basically, yeah, yeah. I guess a lot of it at that point was just me in denial, I guess, about what was going on. You know, I knew it wasn't normal, and I think I knew it wasn't normal.
Felt like you were powerless to stop it, though?
Powerless. It felt like the way he made it feel was almost as if he made it feel like I was choosing to do it.
And that it wouldn't be happening if it wasn't for you, so therefore he wasn't to blame.
Yeah, yeah, basically.
How did that affect how you saw yourself?
I was lost, needed a way out or something like that.
And perhaps was it like a feeling that deep down something was wrong with you rather than the world around you?
It went to, you know, self-esteem, body image, all that sort of stuff. Because I guess to me, the way I kind of saw it was, if I wanted a father kind of figure in my life at that point, that's what I had to do.
He was offering part of what you felt like you needed and wanted, and it came at this heinous cost, but because of your inexperience and your vulnerability at that stage and the confusion you were in and the manipulation, you sort of thought, well, that the pros outweigh the cons, or even that you'd been lured into believing that the other, what he was expecting, was okay.
most of the feelings I was feeling was more around like shame, guilt, self-esteem. I guess at that point in my life, I was quite good at bottling things up.
You'd put on a front pretty effectively?
Pretty much, yeah. Like I put on a front to even myself, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Or if I heard something else mentioned that was along the same lines, you know, that's when I'd start getting those feelings again and I feel a bit uneasy and all that sort of stuff.
And how long did this go on for?
So it went on till almost 16. I eventually asked my father if I could go live with him. He'd moved back from America to Sydney. I guess at that point, that was my way out. I figured I could try and, you know, actually have a normal father. I told my mother I was moving away. That was probably the hardest thing I've ever done.
And why? Why was that?
I literally broke her heart.
And you couldn't tell her why?
And yeah, I can completely understand it from her view. Like, you know, she's after 16 years and stuff like that, she would have felt like I was just trying to see the greener grass on the other side or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, and it was her fault and it was because they weren't good enough or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And that, of course, wasn't the truth, but you weren't at the point where you were going to be able to say the real reason.
Exactly, yeah. After that, like, it was pretty much fights nonstop in the family, just verbal fights and stuff like that.
And you did go and live with your dad?
And yeah, and then, just before my 16th birthday, I moved over to live with my dad, who then moved to Adelaide, and that's how I got away from it.
And by this point, were you reflecting on it and viewing that relationship differently to the way you had when it started?
I knew it wasn't normal. I knew I needed to get away. Felt guilt about, one, my mother and, you know, my brothers and sisters and stepdad. Felt guilty about my friends. I mean, the other people that were staying there, and I was just kind of like leaving them behind.
And no one could actually know why.
Yeah.
What stopped you telling anyone at that point?
I thought I was okay. It was a shame, guilt, and I thought I was strong enough to deal with it myself, so I didn't need to bring it up or tell anyone about it.
But you also thought you had to get away.
Yeah.
Were you worried about freaking them out and upsetting other people? Or you just weren't ready to accept that yourself?
It was, more of a running away from the problem, masking it kind of to the extent that, you know, I tricked myself into thinking that I didn't need to tell anyone about it. And I guess there was no benefit in telling anyone about it to me. So it was just...
Because it had happened and you were ashamed of it. So you felt like, if I can just get away and move on with my life and never talk about that, then it'll go away and no one has to know.
Yeah, that's pretty much exactly, yeah.
What was it like to live with that trauma and that burden for the next 5 years?
So year 11 and 12, I isolated myself, like the kind of kid that just went home and sat in his room sort of thing.
Were you conscious of why you were doing that?
I thought I was just doing what was making me happy sort of thing. I don't know, well, not happy, but like doing what I just wanted to do, and that's just who I was.
And you were working really hard at school and
trying
to keep yourself occupied.
I worked a couple of days a week, did school, played sport, pretty much every waking hour I was studying, but wasn't doing anything.
What was the denial like? Was your mind often thinking about that abuse or not really?
It just pushed it locked it all out. The way down. I pushed it so far down that I didn't even realise that it was a problem. Not even a thought crossed my mind that that was the reason that everything was happening. If triggers came up, like something that reminded me then, you know, I'd get those shameful, guilty feelings.
And that wouldn't feel good, so you'd want to put that back in the box as quickly as possible.
Pretty much. I just try and, like... I'm just going to avoid this issue for a little bit.
How did it stunt your relationships? Like, did you have friends once you'd relocated? What about relationships with, you know, girlfriends, etc.?
I kind of bounced from relationship to relationship. Wanted to be alone, but at the same time couldn't be alone. I don't know how to describe that.
Like you needed company, but you couldn't really connect?
Yeah, pretty much. That point in my life, 17, 18, I pretty much, and even today, actually, I still just keep busy. It's just always been my coping mechanism, I guess.
And was it difficult with trust too?
Trust in the way that it was more, I'd get into a relationship, I would think it's gonna end or inevitably I wouldn't be good enough. So then I'd just start like pushing them.
So you'd sabotage.
Yeah. Make it feel like I was in control or something like that.
Are you a heterosexual man?
Yeah.
So that must have been very confusing too.
Yeah. There's definitely questions there.
And that was part of the guilt that you felt around knowing that you are attracted to women, yet this had happened. So what did that mean?
Yeah, and it was like a weird thing where I was still a bit like, I was out but still a bit trapped in the situation. I kind of got a bit, I don't know how to explain it. I'd be in relationships with females but still like trying to find ways to, I don't know, almost like go back to the abuse. I don't know if that makes sense.
So had you developed like a sexual attraction or link to that kind of abusive sort of environment?
That's exactly what I was trying to say. Right. Yeah.
Which obviously not natural for you and wouldn't have happened, you wouldn't think, if you hadn't gone through what you went through.
No. And, you know, at the same time, I was attracted to women and, that was...
But you'd been, from a young age, conditioned sexually that abuse was linked to sex, and so that was hard to shake.
Yeah.
And so how did that made those relationships difficult? That was because people you were dating at the time wouldn't have understood that, or you wouldn't have...
I didn't even understand it.
Or like normal sex you weren't sort of interested in and...
Not really.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. I guess it even took me like years of psychology to figure out that sort of stuff.
How else did it manifest in your behaviour? So having this inside you, because you started to act out more as a result of it. So you tell us about that.
It's like an impulsive, like really impulsive. I stopped being able to like, I guess I can commit to anything.
What about like drugs and alcohol sort of thing?
So that was after I'd moved away until when I was about 18, 19, that's when it really started hitting. That's when like the depression hit to what I now realise is anxiety and all that sort of stuff. I started getting like a lot more of the like flashbacks. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah. So you'd had that capacity to really push it from your mind and genuinely not go there.
Yeah.
And then it started to come out involuntarily and you couldn't stop thinking about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Then that's when I started getting a bit more into drinking. Always a bit of like a party animal, but.
And were you conscious of using that as a coping mechanism, or you just sort of felt like you liked it and everyone did it? And
it was when I started doing it during the weeks and, you know, getting drunk every day in a week sort of thing. That's when I started realizing, hey, I need to, something's going on here.
And were you doing that because it would stop those thoughts for a bit?
Stop every thought, just escape reality, I guess. Yeah, I used to have, I keep a goon sack in the fridge and I'd fill up a glass of wine and then put a dash of water in it, and that's what I would just keep drinking that during the weeks. And I'm pretty thankful that luckily I kind of like figured out what was going on. Not figured out, just realised that
you weren't going down a good road.
Yeah. If I did go out and drink with my friends, it was, you know, at least a slab. If I wasn't blacking out by the end of it, then there was no point.
Getting obliterated.
Yeah. And not being able to not be obliterated, if that makes sense. And...
But knowing by this time, but that's because you were running from something.
Yeah, running from everything. And then I just, at some point, can't even remember. Yeah, I was in a relationship with a psychologist at this point. Well, psychologist student she was pretty worried about me.
She was the first person you told about the abuse?
Yeah, she was the first person, and still very much remember the exact day that I told her. I was definitely a cunt towards her, and she would, like, tried absolutely everything to try and get me to, you know, speak to my parents about it, or I don't know why, I just couldn't.
And all that anger and confusion you were feeling, you took some of it out on her because she was there.
I was a controlling asshole.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she was supportive and a good person, and yeah. How did she respond when you told her about that, the abuse?
She was, again, I guess in my head, I tended to play it down a little bit at that point, and I told her about it, and I remember her being like, basically, like, a bit of a, not what the fuck, but like, it was a big deal for me to tell her. And, you know, I guess the hardest bit is, like, at that point, I don't remember what it was like to not be that person, so.
Like, she made it very obvious just how wrong and unusual that was.
Yeah. Not in, like, a bad way, but in, like, a, you know, you should actually talk to someone about this.
Yeah, so you were sort of saying, like, this thing happened to me and I don't really know if it's that big of a deal. But yeah. Then she was like, yeah, it is.
Yeah, like, yeah, a bit of a, I'm a 20-year-old male, I can take on anything, but, yeah, I couldn't take on myself. Then it started getting a little bit more serious. I started changing from that gentle, timid, respectful guy to, like, I remember one time in town, like, I just snapped, and, like, not like a, you know, you get in a fight and it's a fight sort of thing, but, like, I just snapped and threw this guy against the wall, and, like, that's when I started getting, like, scared of myself. I don't know how to explain that.
That you were out of control.
Yeah. That was, like, there was two people there, and all I wanted to do was, like, belt the fuck out of both of them. And then...
And you had a sense that that wasn't you. That wasn't the sort of person you knew yourself to be.
Yeah, I was... It was more of a... I couldn't even stop it if I tried, I don't...
Like, it was coming through you.
Yeah, and then, you know, I started getting a few more fights, stuff like that. Like, didn't care what the repercussions were and
was
all this.
Was part of that wanting to get hurt?
It was just all anger. Yeah. I don't know how to... It was just a... Like, an explosion, and then you'd, like, after, like, as soon as you did it, it was like, what the fuck just happened? Yeah.
Because you bottled that thing for so long, and then this was it, having to come out in the ugliest way possible.
Yeah. It was, I guess, my body just saying, like, well, if you're not going to do anything about it, I'm going to do something about it.
And force it to the surface
sort of
thing.
Yeah.
And you ended up in a jail cell one night, didn't you?
Yeah. I was abusive, a dick, even like running away from cops on motorbikes and stuff like that.
You were dicing with death and doing some real dangerous stuff, and that was a result of the crescendo of this coming out and this sort of beast within you.
Yeah.
And that got you in some trouble.
Yeah. Ended up getting locked up for a day, and had all the court shit to do with that. And that's kind of when it clicked that I needed to do something about it. And that's when I got locked up is the time that I started telling my family about it. And because they were like, what the fuck's going on? Like, what the hell's going on?
Did you get to the point of being suicidal before that?
So, yeah, that was a good 4 or 5 months before that, cutting all that sort of stuff. It was just pain. That's all I could feel. I couldn't pinpoint it. I couldn't say what was, like, I still I had an attempt at that point. And then, yeah, after my family then found out, that's when I started actually seeing psychologists and stuff like that.
So your family found out about the attempt, but they still didn't know about the abuse?
Yeah, no, they didn't know about the abuse at that point.
And when you did tell them about the abuse, how did they react?
My dad slept outside my door on the floor for like days. My family pretty much all of them came over to Adelaide and like just didn't want to leave me. My elder brother actually moved to Adelaide just to look after me.
Don't apologise. What was it like for you to tell someone after all those years? Well, I know you told your ex-partner before that, but to tell your family why all this had happened? Because it had been just you, Bert, shouldering this whole time.
Look, it did turn my world upside down, I guess. It was already upside down, but it did. Even to this day, it's still a big part of my life, unfortunately.
Did it feel like a good thing, though, when you were able to share it?
I felt lighter. And through sharing it, it helped me get professional help that helped me. Does that make sense? So, and it just helped me understand what was going on. And that was the biggest thing. Like, the main thing was...
So you had some guidance?
Yeah.
With it? It wasn't just you in orbit with no idea how to put the pieces together.
That's pretty, yeah, exactly. I had lots of mental health people helping me out. Helped me to like be able to understand how to channel anger before it got too much, if that makes sense. Like even to this day, like I can still snap. It's never gonna go away, I don't think. I don't know, maybe in the future it'll go away, hopefully. But just, it was more about, they helped me understand, like, what was going on, who I was, and what I needed to do to be able to, I guess, like, survive. Whether it be, like, at some points, I was going to the driving range every single day, purely just to belt the fuck out of golf balls.
Better to belt a golf ball.
Yeah. I mean, it got to the point I was hitting, like, some golf balls were hitting 350
meters. There you go, turning pro almost.
Yeah. No, I was terrible at golf. Just couldn't belt the ball.
Didn't go straight, but it went far.
Yeah.
So they gave you some tools for once and some healthy coping mechanisms.
Yeah. At that point in my life, that's when it came to the surface, I guess. I couldn't mask it anymore. So, unfortunately, it's still, most days, it's, even if it's, I mean, like, what, it comes up, but in my brain, and you got all the, like, thinking about it as well as that, but, I'm still trying to, it's still actually, in my day-to-day life, it's still part of my day-to-day life doing through legal shit and legal stuff and all that sort of stuff. So it's hard to know what my normal will look like when that's all done, but yeah.
It's not like something this traumatic happens to you and you just get over it and you do the recovery and, that's okay. It's what you're saying is it permeates your whole life, and then having to go through the court proceedings around it, you've made all this progress through going through therapy and being so brave and confronting it and having all this support, but it's still something that a lot of your life is based around, because you have these proceedings going on and you still have this stuff in your mind, and it's not something that you can be fully free of, at least not yet.
No, it's even last year I still ended up in hospital, and that was, I just got so angry that I just couldn't deal with my anger and I had to go to hospital, and they basically just pump full of Valium and stuff just to
sedate you.
Yeah, you know, it's not a straight narrow path and like this is what'll work and it'll never happen again. Like it,
something that you live with.
Yeah, yeah.
And you were not an angry boy.
Even now, people go, "You're not angry."
But that's one of the scars. In a positive sense, what's the biggest difference between you now and you 7 years ago?
I'm not taking my shit out on other people. Definitely the biggest positive. I'm angry, but at the same time, I've worked out how to kind of funnel it into the right things to do. Like, what, a couple of weeks ago? Like, I'm not a skinny guy, and I was just so angry that I just went and ran, and like, I ended up running like 21 Ks. And
but you got to put that energy somewhere.
Yeah. Had the same song on repeat and just kept running.
What's the song?
Yeah. I Can't by 50 Cent.
Oh, yeah. Good song.
It was a good song.
Maybe not like 25 times in a row, but I like that song too.
Yeah. He's still an icon.
He is. You view yourself as a survivor now.
Yeah, yeah. It's hard going through the, like the legal stuff. They kind of push that victim word.
That's not how you look at it.
No. I definitely was, but I don't want to be
defined by that.
Yeah, and I guess don't, if, you know, if you say victim, you're kind of letting them still have power over you or something like that.
And what have you done to get that power back for yourself?
Honestly, this legal side is a lot of it.
He was convicted. You were awarded by the court reparations
yep.
that you are owed, yep. and you haven't been paid those reparations, and that's because he has found a way to not pay you.
Yeah, so basically, even before I went in on the legal stuff, a lawyer by the name of Andrew Carpenter gave me a lot of advice and helped me out. Basically, what they do is they move their money around, either put it overseas or with someone they trust or something like that, and then put some of it in super or leave money in super. The idea being that you can sue as much as you want, but you're not going to ever see a cent of it. After going through the legal side, basically what they do is they offer you a settlement, which is pretty much nothing. They kind of say, if you're not going to take this, well, you're not going to get anything. There is no money to take. All the money in super you can't access. And
because of the way the law is.
Yeah, yeah.
And so then it's either take that settlement and then go away and nothing changes, or it's you try and change the law.
It's take the settlement, go away, but then also the big part of it is signing NDAs. So then also, like, you're not really meant to talk about it either. I never knew about any of this stuff beforehand.
So you've been fighting this for a long time and it still hasn't gotten to a point where...
The police stuff started over 6 years ago. And then, yeah, so it's been... First, there was a criminal conviction process. Then he got convicted. He got 9 years. But in Australia, he basically got served... It gets served concurrently, which means that 8 of the years he got were seen as already served. So he only got 1 year in prison for that.
Already served, like what, because he was in, was he in prison?
He was in prison for many other victims.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so he got 9 years for your case specifically.
Yep.
Right, but he'd already been in prison for that.
Yeah, but they basically say, well, he's done a lot of the same stuff, so.
Right, so they don't add it on. They just say. Right.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. So you're like, we'll give you an extra year. Yeah, then we went through all this legal stuff, eventually found a lawyer that helped me out, and we went through all the, like, the usual stuff. By the end, you get offered a settlement that says, like,
this is what you can have, and
yeah,
too bad if you don't like it, basically.
Yeah. At that point, I was a bit... I felt defeated, so I did actually offer him a counter settlement, which was probably six times what he offered. And then he countered with another settlement offer, which was like, I think, half of legal costs. So at the end of it, I would have been basically in debt half of my legal costs. This is kind of a joke. This is ridiculous.
There must be a big part of you that wants it to be over.
A lot of it. But I wasn't expecting to get... I'm not even sure if I'm going to get anything out of this. You know, at the moment, I'm probably like 100K in debt. I think about the NDAs and I just think about like how many other people, like people that you wouldn't even know because there's no possible legal way of actually knowing. Because, you know, I was one of many victims. I know these people. I know the pain, like, just, like, not even, like, just this law has caused all these survivors.
Why don't you just give up?
I ask myself that all the time. It's one thing to be a kid and, like, be controlled by someone like that in put in that scenario. But then, like, for me personally, what I feel is it's their way of keeping it going. Like, it's just the same abuse, just, well, not the same abuse,
but that cycle.
Yeah.
The cycle of silence continues. And
yeah. And like with the NDAs, I try to, like, trying to get, I guess, silenced, talking about stuff is a good way to, like, help move on with it, and you kind of get rid of all that for survivors of this sort of stuff, of abuse. And
on that, you didn't have to be named and didn't have to go public with your story. Why have you chosen to do that?
The whole time, all through this legal process, you know, I've been getting asked to, you know, do stories like this. Andrew Carpenter, who's the lawyer, who's, you know, he's the guy that's doing all the law changes. I'm just a guy that's going through it. And there's other people involved as well. We were fearful to do it before any of the lawyer stuff, before that last court date in had gone through, because, you know, potentially could get seen as media manipulation or something like that.
Yeah. I understand that, but why is it important to you to put your face to it and share your story now?
It's not for me. It's for other people. I know how powerful a story can be. I'd like other people to not get stuck in that same situation that I was in. Now, I understand a lot of other people cope with things differently. Everyone's story is going to be different to mine. I want anyone that's been in the same or similar, you know, it doesn't have to be doesn't have to be limited to sexual abuse. It could be, you know, physical abuse as a child or something like that. I was lucky. I could have been in a different, very different path. I could be, you know, I could have been locked up. And if I spoke to someone about this, obviously I did, but it was too late. If I just kind of, like, I don't know, let someone know what had happened, then I think everything would have been very different.
So that's what you'd change. You'd go back and not just hold on to that by yourself for so long.
Definitely, yeah. I don't know if, you know, what path I would have went down or any of that sort of stuff, but I think, you know, if I just, you know, even when the police first asked me if it happened, like when I was younger, they asked me if it happened and I denied it. You know, if I just said yes, like, all of a sudden it kind of changes a lot of things that potentially can lead you down a different path. And really the only downside to it was, I mean, there wasn't really a downside. Like, I thought being, you know, ashamed of it and all this stuff was the reason.
You thought it would be worse to talk about it. Yeah. It proved not to be.
Yeah.
And then a lot of the damage was done to you and to other people because that monster rose up inside of you because it needed to come out.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think I've told anyone this where they haven't been 100% supportive or, you know, I don't think I've ever been made to feel ashamed from anyone I've ever told. Yeah, ever. I think it's society's well enough along that everyone realises that.
Well, survivors deserve respect and people understand that they've been preyed upon.
Yeah.
And it's not your fault.
When one of my youngest brothers turned 14, I remember, when I was 14, I felt like an adult. Like, I felt like, I was a big man. And then I looked at my little brother who was 14 and I was like, if that ever happened to him, I don't know what I'd do, but there's no way in the world I would ever blame him for it. And I was young. It wasn't my choice.
And you can totally forgive yourself for any of that guilt or shame that you held at a point now where you can reflect and see that that was done to you.
Yeah. Hindsight, hey?
Yeah.
It definitely helped me put it in perspective.
You're much more than what happened to you when you were a kid. And you're an adult man now, and you've got a lot of life ahead of you, and you've got a lot of good things in your life despite this terrible thing that happened to you. Where do you go from here?
At the moment, the law change is a huge, huge part of that. Honestly, I can't take any... I'm not behind the law change. I'm just kind of, I guess, the story behind it.
Well, you're brave enough to put your face to that, and that is needed.
So. Yeah, but there's, there's other people who have put their...
Yeah.
That's definitely kind of, at the moment, the main priority. And then after that, I guess, my main goal is to... I guess I've got a lot of goals. It's just, work with myself a lot more and move forward, but understand that I do things differently to everyone else. I can't work for other people at all. So, figuring out a way to...
Work for yourself.
Yeah. And, at some point in the future, I'd love to, have a business that's profitable enough that I can just fund everyone's legal fees to, if they're in the same situation as me. I guess I'm still that same selfless, kind, generous person. And
you want to be that man?
Yeah, I want to, be that man again.
What else do you want out of life, to put simply?
Find peace. Help all the other people that got fucked over. Sorry, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to swear.
You can swear, man.
One of the big things I've always been scared of is the day that he gets out of prison. Finding a way to let it go and be at peace with it. But, at the same time, allow it to be something that pushes me forward and drives me. And I never really wanted to be, an advocate or...
Of course not.
...known for this sort of stuff. But I think my desire to want to help other people is more than, that I care that if people know this about me, if that makes sense. I don't know if that answers your question.
It does.
Yeah.
Well, Eden, thanks for sharing your story, man. I can appreciate how incredibly difficult that is to do, to reflect on that in that detail and try to articulate something that pretty much impossible to articulate in some ways. And I just really admire your bravery and your commitment, resilience, resolve in continuing to deal with this and have it drag on for so long and still stay optimistic and still want to fight for other people. I don't think you should feel like it's your responsibility to change this for everyone, but I certainly admire that you're taking that on and you are fighting for justice yeah. that you deserve. And I think it's beautiful that despite all this, you're still that generous, compassionate, gentle soul deep down who wants to be there for everyone else. And actually that's a main priority
yeah.
for you. And he obviously hasn't been able to take that from you and no one ever will. And I just think you should be just tremendously proud of yourself for everything that you've done and continue to do. And you just seem like a wonderful young man. And yeah, I just got so much admiration for you to be able to come out and speak like that and do that for others, because people need a voice. And this is just the hardest topic to talk about, and something that is yeah. really common, and so many people deal with it in silence, and silence just perpetuates the problem, man. So thank you for doing that for the sake of others, and I hope you are able to find peace and to be able to move on as much as possible, because you certainly deserve that.
Thank you for having me on the show. I'll try my best. That's all I can say.
That's it for this episode. If you like what we're all about, support us by following Youngblood Men's Mental Health on Instagram and Youngblood Mental Health on TikTok. Every podcast episode is recorded in professional quality video, and they're all up on our Youngblood Men's Mental Health YouTube channel. So please show some love and subscribe.
A big thanks to our local business supporters, Pro Realty Property Consultants and Herd Financial.
You can find everything there is to know about the podcast at youngbloodmensmentalhealth.com. And most importantly, please share these stories with anyone in your life who needs to know they're not alone. We're all in this together. Catch you next time.